VOA News, I'm Tommy McNeil. A suicide bomber barreled into a crowd outside a restaurant in northern Syrian town of Manbij and blew himself up, killing four Americans and raising questions about what happens once U.S. forces pull out for good. The Islamic State terror group quickly claimed responsibility for Wednesday's attack, identifying the bomber as one of its Syrian fighters and said he had targeted a patrol of U.S. and coalition forces. Doctors in Manbij told VOA two U.S. service members were killed instantly. Officials with the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces said the wounded were rushed to medical facilities in neighboring Iraq. In a statement late Wednesday, the U.S. military said a civilian employee and a defense contractor were also killed in the blast. Three other troops were injured.
The U.S.-led coalition says the U.S. troops were conducting a routine patrol when they were hit by an explosion. The Islamic State group has claimed responsibility for the attack. It's the first instance of U.S. casualties since President Trump announced his intention to withdraw troops from Syria last month.
That's AP correspondent Ben Thomas. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence is claiming that the Islamic State caliphate has crumbled and the militant network has been defeated.
Thanks to the leadership of this commander-in-chief and the courage and sacrifice of our armed forces, we're now actually able to begin to hand off the fight against ISIS in Syria to our coalition partners, and we are bringing our troops home. The caliphate has crumbled and ISIS has been defeated.
And in a speech Wednesday at the State Department, Vice President Pence defended President Trump's decision to withdraw roughly 2,000 U.S. troops from Syria. Find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Federal prosecutors are investigating Huawei Technologies, the world's largest telecommunications equipment maker, for allegedly stealing trade secrets from U.S. businesses and could soon issue an indictment. Citing people familiar with the matter, the Wall Street Journal said that one area of investigation is the technology behind a device that T-Mobile U.S. Incorporated used for testing smartphones. Reuters could not immediately confirm that report. The International Criminal Court has ordered former Ivory Coast president and his top aide to remain in custody after judges acquitted them of crimes against humanity. Prosecutors immediately appealed Tuesday's verdict and argued the pair may refuse to return to The Hague for a trial if the not guilty verdict is overturned. Kenya's president has vowed to track down terrorists who staged a deadly assault Tuesday on a hotel and office complex in an upscale suburb of the capital city. The president said all attackers have been eliminated and warned his government is launching an aggressive manhunt for all of those involved. Police say at least 21 people were killed in Nairobi's D2 complex, where surveillance video showed at least four gunmen walking through the parking lot as the siege began in the mid-afternoon. Security forces in Zimbabwe arrested a pastor and a political activist at his home as a nationwide anti-government strike entered its third and final day. Correspondent Columbus Mavunga reports for VOA that NGOs and opposition parties are accusing the police and army of assaulting protesters.
On Wednesday, armed police surrounded the home of Pastor Ivan Mawarire before arresting him for helping organize a three-day stay-at-home strike to protest Zimbabwe's 150% fuel hike. On Wednesday, more than 200 protesters were brought to court and more are expected Thursday to face charges of violence.
That is VOA correspondent Columbus Mavunga reporting. The U.S. Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, suggested Wednesday that President Trump delay his State of the Union address planned for later this month unless the record-setting partial government shutdown ends this week, or present the speech instead in writing. Pelosi cited security preparations needed for the annual high-profile event before Congress, which is scheduled for January 29th. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 17th. And here are some of the stories we're covering. Kenyan police give final tally of the dead and the wounded in Tuesday's terror attack.
As of this evening, six other bodies were found at the scene, and one police officer succumbed very sadly to his injuries. 28 persons were admitted to various hospitals in Nairobi. And third, five terrorists were eliminated.
Joseph Bonet is Kenya's Inspector General of Police. An analyst will explain why Kenya appears to be an easy target for Al-Shabaab militant attacks. The African Union meets today in Addis Ababa to discuss Congo's disputed election. Meanwhile, Congolese await a court ruling on a challenge to the election results. And Zimbabwe security forces are accused of brutalizing protesters.
It is everyone's right under the Zimbabwean Constitution and Universal Declaration of Human Rights to be able to express themselves in any manner they see fit. We ask the security forces not to be excessive in their response to people exercising their freedom.
Jacob Mafume is a spokesman for the opposition MDC. Uganda's President Museveni promises to increase university lecturer's salary, and two leading opposition figures are barred from participating in next month's Senegal presidential election. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The death toll from Tuesday's Al-Shabaab militant attacks on a Kenyan hotel complex has risen to 21, with as many as 28 people wounded. Joseph Bonet, Kenya's Inspector General of Police, gave the final tally at a late news conference Wednesday in Nairobi.
Following further forensic work by the DCI, we wish to inform that as of this evening, this is the final tally. Six other bodies were found at the scene, and one police officer succumbed very sadly to his injuries while undergoing treatment. Number two, 28 persons were admitted to various hospitals in Nairobi. And third, five terrorists were eliminated. These are the nationalities of the persons who very sadly lost their lives. 16 Kenyans, 1 Briton, 1 American, and 3 persons of African descent whom we are yet to identify. In subsequent investigations by the DCI, we have arrested 2 individuals whom we have very strong reasons to believe facilitated the attack and are in our custody assisting the police with the investigations. We wish once again to thank all Kenyans, including our friends, globally, on the part of our people for the patience and the cooperation during the course of the investigations. We once again wish to commend our officers and other members of the multi-agency security teams, including emergency response teams, as well as our hospitals, for the support.
That was Joseph Bonet, Kenya's Inspector General of Police, speaking late Wednesday in Nairobi. An analyst says Kenya's porous borders, especially with neighboring Somalia, has made the country susceptible to Al-Shabaab militant attacks. Rashid Abdi, the Horn of Africa Project Director for the International Crisis Group, explains to VOA's Esther Gitui.
I think the first thing to remember is that Kenya has a long porous border with Somalia. This border has traditionally not been very well policed, and partly because since independence, the governments in Nairobi did not want to put a very strong border, largely because that would have caused a great deal of resentment, because communities or clans straddle both sides of the border. And that explains why Al-Shabaab is able to infiltrate Kenya at ease.
But Kenya is not the only regional country with forces in Somalia. Ethiopia has troops there too, and their neighboring countries as well. What is Ethiopia doing that Kenya is not?
It's a good question. I think Kenya has historically been, a very open country with a very liberal political tradition and culture. And, Ethiopia, whereas Ethiopia was, a very security-minded state, it was a national security state and very strong on security. And I think because of the legacy of the Marxist-Leninist system, you also had a very well-organized local security systems which worked very efficiently, whereas that wasn't the case in Kenya. Kenya, for a variety of historical reasons, did not join that kind of a Stalinist tradition. So there are I think, differences in terms of political culture and traditions, which makes Kenya very susceptible to this kind of infiltration.
I spoke to President Uhuru Kenyatta last August and asked him if he would listen to some of the legislators calling for the withdrawal of the Kenya Defence Forces in Somalia. They argue a move like that may possibly end Al-Shabaab attacks in the country. But Kenyatta said not until Somalia is stable and able to take control of its own security. So do you think, Abdi, keeping the forces in Somalia jeopardizes Kenya's security?
I think there is no doubt that as long as you have troops deployed in Somalia, Al-Shabaab will use it as a major, first of all, recruitment tool, but also secondly, as a reason and a justification for their attacks in Kenya. And so, you know, a withdrawal, in theory, will probably remove one of the major reasons for Al-Shabaab to strike Kenya. But I think matters are much more complicated than that. You know, even if Kenya were to pull out its troops from southern Somalia tomorrow, I doubt whether you will see a significant scaling down of Al-Shabaab activities in Kenya. I think Al-Shabaab's strategic aim is not just to destabilize, to have the troops withdrawn, but I think also to destabilize the wider region, because I think their end goal is to create an Islamic state in the Horn of Africa. And so this destabilization, I think, is part of the longer-term strategic aims of Al-Shabaab. And so I think it's a bit naive to think that a withdrawal of Kenyan troops will simply satisfy Al-Shabaab and they will stop attacking Kenya.
Rashid Abdi is the Horn of Africa Project Director for the International Crisis Group. He spoke with viewers Esther Kitui. African leaders are meeting today in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa, to discuss the disputed election in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Yesterday, Wednesday, the Southern African Development Community, SADC, held a double troika summit, also in the Ethiopian capital, on the Congolese election. SADC has called for a recount of the vote and the formation of a unity government. The Electoral Commission has already declared Felix Tshisekedi winner of the December 30th elections, but Martin Fayulu, who took second place, has challenged the results in court. Andre Alain Atundu is the spokesman for DRC President Joseph Kabila's ruling Common Front for Congo coalition. He says there is no need for a united government.
There is no particular problem in Congo about the result of the elections, except this appeal of Mr. Fayulu to the court. And I think it is normal. And the court heard Mr. Fayulu team, Mr. Tshisekedi team, Seni team, and then he postponed the judgment for 1 week, I think. So there's no particular reason to call for a special kind of government. It depends on what the Constitution says about the form of the government. If there is a majority identified in the parliament, Kabila team, with 350 members of parliament for 500. So the elected president, Mr. Tshisekedi, had to choose a prime among the Kabila coalition. That's what the constitution says. And the conclusion will depend also on how the dialogue about this next government. But I don't think it's a particular problem. There is no tension. There is no particular feeling to fear of any social explosion. No, I think it's normal.
Well, as I was saying, the African Union is meeting today, Thursday, and SADC has also called for recount and a unity government. So the concern is that there's some forensic evidence that perhaps Mr. Tshisekedi did not win the election, that Mr. Fayulu probably won.
Yes, I think it's normal. That's why he contests the results. But the definitive result, it will be what the court will say. This one, Mr. Tshisekedi, is the winner and Mr. Fayulu is the loser. It depends on the judgment of the court. So it's normal between the job of the court to recount the voters and to make a conclusion. We are waiting for this judgment. I mean all the nation, because in majority team, we are not part of this court appeal.
Is it likely that the Constitutional Court can rule that there should be a recount?
It's normal. Because what Mr. Fayulu team asked to recount the ballots, and what the court will do, probably to recount and not to give the results, because the recounting of the ballots depends on the Seni figures in comparison with Fayulu figures. He announced that he was the winner, but does he have evidence enough to sustain this announcement? This is the court's job.
Andre Alain Atundu is the spokesman for DRC President Joseph Kabila's ruling Common Front for Congo Coalition. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 17th, and please send your comments and opinions to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time now, 16 minutes past the hour. Protests in Zimbabwe over a fuel price hike entered the third and final planned day on Wednesday, with police arresting a pastor accused of inciting violence via social media. As Columbus Mavunga reports, NGOs and opposition parties are accusing the police and the army of assaulting protesters.
Early Wednesday, armed police surrounded the home of Pastor Ivan Mawarire before arresting him for helping organize a three-day stay-at-home strike to protest Zimbabwe's 150% fuel hike. Aton Beatrice Mtetwa of Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights is representing Mawarire.
They're alleging that he has incited violence through Twitter and other forms of social media. We've asked for full particulars, when, how. They say they don't know. They'll give that to him at the police station. We've asked how asking for people to stay away can constitute incitement to violence. But of course, this is a new dispensation, guys.
On Tuesday, the government said a policeman was killed when demonstrations began Monday. It accused the protesters of terrorism acts, which included looting and setting fire to property and vehicles, mainly government-owned. Zimbabwe's main opposition said it was actually the army and police assaulting protesters. MDC spokesman Jacob Mafume.
It is everyone's right under the Zimbabwean Constitution and Universal Declaration of Human Rights to be able to express themselves in any manner they see fit. We ask the security forces not to be excessive in their response to people exercising their freedom. Loss of life must be avoided at all costs. The solution is there. The solution is dialogue. We notice that there has been a shutdown in terms of internet communication that needs to be opened.
Zimbabwean authorities shut down internet access Tuesday, saying citizens were using social media to spread malicious information about the strike that turned violent on its first day. President Emmerson Mnangagwa is in Russia as part of his five-nation visit that ends by attending the World Economic Forum next week in Davos, Switzerland. Before leaving, he dismissed opposition allegations that the trip was just a jaunt.
My visit to the first four states will enhance bilateral relations in line with our policy of engagement. My visit this time around will focus predominantly on bilateral economic engagement, especially in areas of mining, technology, agriculture, energy, and human capital development, among others.
On Wednesday, more than 200 protesters were brought to court, and more are expected Thursday to face charges of violence. Mnangagwa shocked many when he announced the fuel price increase, a task legally done by the Zimbabwe Energy Regulatory Agency in consultation with the energy minister. The government says the 150% fuel hike is meant to ensure the country is able to import adequate supplies of the commodity that has been in acute shortage for months. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
The International Criminal Court has ordered former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo and his top aide to remain in custody even after judges acquitted them of crimes against humanity. Prosecutors immediately appealed Tuesday's verdict and argue that the pair may refuse to return to The Hague for trial if the not guilty verdict is overturned. But the three-judge panel called the prosecutor's case exceptionally weak. Gbagbo and Charles Blaise Goudé had been on trial for alleged crimes against humanity stemming from the violence in Ivory Coast after the 2010 election. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni says his government will increase payments for university lecturers. President Museveni is also promising to help fund university graduates and create employment opportunities. Magumi Davis Rob Karinch reports from Kampala.
While presiding over 69th graduation ceremony at Uganda's oldest university, Makerere University, President Museveni said his government is working towards ensuring that university lecturers and professors get good salaries.
Our plan has always been to ensure that the university staff are remunerated eventually up to standards comparable to world standards of remuneration.
The president did not say by how much or when university lecturers' salaries will be increased. In recent months, lecturers and professors from public universities have laid down their tools in protest of low payments. Last month, teaching and non-teaching staff in public universities across the country resolved not to resume work this year unless the government fulfills its promises to increase salaries and clear salary areas. Currently, junior and senior university professors are paid a monthly salary of 3 million to 8 million Uganda shillings, or about $1,000 to $2,000 respectively. President Museveni said his government will avail grants and startup capital for fresh graduates so they can be self-employed rather than seeking for employment.
I look after cattle, and cattle have skins and hides, and it is skins and hides where you make shoes from, and yet you say my grandchildren don't have jobs. No, we are just disorganized. What you do, you form a group, you do the leather tanning. I will form groups near the abattoir there. You young people form a group to go and do leather tanning. Near Kampala here, we don't have to go very far.
On her part, the First Lady and Minister of Education, Janet Kataha Museveni, said her ministry is investing in research projects aimed at finding solutions for people in Uganda and across the region.
On several occasions, I have received delegations of Makerere University and her local international partners who are jointly looking for solutions to problems that affect our country's development. These include research in health issues, agriculture and food security, youth unemployment and efficient use of petroleum and gas, among others.
Over 13,000 students graduated in various social sciences and science disciplines with PhDs, master's degrees and postgraduate diplomas, bachelor's degrees and diplomas. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Senegal's Constitutional Court ruled this week that two of the country's leading opposition figures, Khalifa Sall and Karim Wade, will be barred from participating in the presidential elections next month. Sall and Wade were jailed for graft in previous years. Incumbent Macky Sall, no relation to Khalifa Sall, is almost certain to win the poll. Alex Thorsten, a visiting assistant professor in political science and comparative religion at Miami University in Ohio, has followed the Senegalese electoral process. He spoke to Ricky Stryak about what the ruling means.
Certainly the court made reference to the electoral code and to you know, the legal, you know, penalties and condemnations that have been handed down against both, you know, these politicians. But at the same time, it does, you know, give the appearance of the incumbent using the powers of the state to shape the political playing field in advance of the election.
Dakar's current mayor, Khalifa Sall, is one of the people whose candidacy was deemed invalid. He's in prison for misappropriation of money. How much do you know about his actual trial and the charges against him?
I mean, so he's accused of embezzling public money and, you know, was arrested, I believe, for the first time in 2017 and has been, you know, condemned in March of 2018. You know, I think there are still appeals and legal avenues, you know, remaining to him. And so that's one of the complaints from his supporters' side, is that, you know, the legal process is not completely concluded. And
it's kind of interesting that a West African president does go after corruption and he still gets critiqued for it. What would you say to someone who presents that argument?
Yeah, I mean, I see, you know, the kind of irony that you're talking about. And certainly, you know, particularly in the case of Karim Wade, I don't think a lot of people are saying, you know, aside from his hardcore partisans, I don't think a lot of people are saying, oh, he must be completely innocent. I think, though, that the problem is when, you know, anti-corruption seems politically targeted. And I think that to avoid that charge, a West African president or any president would have to go after corruption in a way that appears even-handed. And I think that would mean, you know, going after some of one's own, you know, supporters and allies and so forth. I mean, in Nigeria, a similar kind of charge has been leveled at, you know, Muhammadu Buhari, the current president, or at past presidents even, that they have used, you know, Nigerian anti-corruption bodies as a political tool rather than as an instrument of good governance.
Khalifa Sall and Karim Wade, they both definitely have their support within Dakar, but they're both very Dakar-based as well. How likely was it that either of them could have rallied enough support outside of the capital, do you think, to actually legitimately challenge Macky Sall?
I think there's a lot of reasons to be concerned about the way that Macky Sall has approached the election and again, the way that he's, you know, shaped the political playing field. But I think it's also quite possible that even had he not done that he would have won, and I expect him to win, but I think he also probably could have won on a completely level playing field because, you know, of the divisions within the opposition. I mean, you know, and the Wade family and Khalifa Sall have attempted alliances in the past, and those fell apart because of disputes they be over, you know, in the last legislative elections, who was going to be at the top of the list. You know, and the pattern has been, especially for, you know, incumbent presidents in Senegal, you know, running for their first re-election, the pattern has often been that they win.
Alex Thorsten is a visiting assistant professor of political science and comparative religion at Miami University in Ohio. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Ohio. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The death toll from Tuesday's Al-Shabaab militants attack on a Kenyan hotel complex has risen to 21, with as many as 28 people wounded. Nearly 900 people were killed in ethnic violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo in mid-December, the United Nations Human Rights Office said on Wednesday. Most of the population of the nearby villages are being displaced, including an estimated 16,000 who crossed the Congo River into neighboring Republic of Congo, according to a statement. And that is it for this Thursday, January 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer John Ellison, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.